I'm Trevor Page. I was interested to hear your rating that you gave the Ontario government when they were debriefed by the expert panel. And I'm wondering whether you can give some examples of what action has actually been taken as a result of their understanding of the science. And don't limit it to Ontario. If you can give us some practical examples. Underlining my point is that, okay, we know the science, we know the problem, you've documented what can happen. Now, what are the politicians actually doing about it?
Source water protection planning is an obvious one, and it's an issue that is here in Alberta as well as in Ontario. And there's no denying that Walkerton was a real wake-up call for the Ministry of the Environment, for the Harris Conservatives, and was really central to the Liberal government platform provincially in terms of differentiating themselves from the Conservatives in terms of dealing with health issues and water quality issues, which is a sacred trust in this country. So looking at the Rob Deloe report and the fact that we are dealing with source water protection planning right across the province, I think this province is very committed, Ontario's government is very committed to ensuring that source water protection planning incorporate climate change into that planning process. So that's very positive and that's very encouraging. And at the end of the day, if that happens, we can walk away from that panel, pat ourselves on the back and say, we made a difference. Beyond that, there are certainly issues with respect to planning, smart growth, infrastructure, in which we have had different speakers come and return to the panel where they have demonstrated a great commitment and great interest in terms of learning from the panel so that they get it right. In essence, where they are able to determine that adaptation is not adaptation to a carbon-constrained future, that adaptation is to changes in temperature, changes in precipitation, changes in extreme events, where they're beginning to think about how we can incorporate that into growth plans, development plans. In Ontario, in the chapter and in my presentation earlier this afternoon, I had identified specifically to Ontario the Lake Simcoe Development Plan, the Northern Ontario Development Plan, as examples where incorporating climate change into that planning process is an opportunity and essential in terms of any kind of viable plan into the future. Low water response programs, same kind of thing. But you're going to have to edit out my comments on the low water response program. But it's the kind of thing where that is absolutely critical and has application to Alberta, I would think, Jim, with respect to, competing water interests. And if you look at the earlier question about Grand River watershed, which is one of the largest groundwater watersheds in Ontario, you've got Cambridge, you've got Waterloo, you've got Guelph, you've got Kitchener, and the expected demand, increase in demand by population growth and growth in the economy, superimpose climate change upon that, tremendous competing interests. And so we have to figure out a way of fairly allocating those water resources and put in the tools and the instruments in place where the fairness can be achieved, and it's a real challenge. I'm not what else, or I'm not sure what else, Trevor, to suggest. But whether or not it's water, whether or not it's infrastructure, whether or not it's in some cases, which I really haven't touched upon, health issues, heat alert response plans, smog advisory plans, dealing with West Nile virus, Lyme disease, all of these things are going to be happening here sooner than you would imagine.
Seriously, if the public doesn't know what the experts are advising government specifically on what action should be taken, And if we don't monitor publicly what is happening or what is not happening, we, the people, cannot apply the pressure necessary to cause the government to act.
Well, and which is why I think communicating the results of the report, I mean, I could have given this straight without commentary, and I thought to myself, you know, one of the great things about talks like this and the fact that NRCan is supporting me, we've got this on tape, don't we, is the fact that word gets out, people read the report, and they see the seriousness of the issue. On the other hand, the way it was released or not released, and especially the Health Canada report, to me demonstrates a lost opportunity. And the fact is the public needs to know how serious a problem this is in order to push our governments to take more proactive actions, to go beyond the rhetoric and the smoke of mirrors, either by the Liberals or by the Conservatives, saying that we are actually doing something about climate change when, in fact, our emission profile continues to grow. So I think knowing about impacts and adaptation is really vital in terms of dealing with the adaptation necessities and realities, but at the same time reminding us that we need to reduce emissions today and now. So I'm often asked in my public talks, if you had $100, how would you spend it on mitigation vis-a-vis adaptation? And my answer is a very straightforward one. We need $200. $100 to mitigation and $100 to adaptation. And until we realize the seriousness of the issue, we're not going to solve this problem or, from an adaptation perspective, address it in any kind of meaningful way.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Knut Peterson. I wonder if you could share your thoughts on how many people do you think this Earth, as we know it, can sustain, and especially if the majority of people would like to have a quality life.
I don't feel in any way, shape, or form to be in an authority to comment on that, and I don't know whether or not my opinion would be worth anything in that regard. I mean, it's at the crux of the problem, the crux of the challenges that we face in terms of population, economic growth, sustainability, and environmental integrity. It seems to me that the more fundamental problem is an equity issue, and whether or not we can sustain the quality of life that we have enjoyed to date more widely and broadly in developing countries. And there's certainly expectations in China and India and others in order to follow that path. And there's no doubt that, you know, the pathway that we've taken, which has been largely fossil fuel-based, if we can somehow magically or more realistically transform the economy in a more green, renewable-based, low-carbon intensity options, that will be a win-win situation for us as well as for them. And, you know, I'm often challenged in terms of, why should Canada do anything when it only contributes 2% of our emissions? And what about China and the fact that they're building a coal plant once a week or whatever? And I said, what unadulterated crapola, if I've ever heard it. And a large part of it, I mean, I just came back from Hong Kong, and they got severe air quality problems. Their economy is tanking. Their big issue is one of resource scarcity as well as full employment. And they're just not going to be able to sustain the middle class that they've created, let alone continue to build upon it. And I think we're going to run into very serious issues, whether or not it's there. I think Gwyn Dyer had talked about the tensions between Pakistan and India that will be exacerbated by climate change over water resources. I think these things are much more real and tangible and worthy of discussion and debate rather than a lot of the dribble that we're often discussing when it comes to how to best deal with climate change. So there's also a very significant distinction between needs and wants. And, you know, we live in a world in which want is often a very central part of our vocabulary. And there's no doubt that the life that we have enjoyed has been applied to 9 billion people this planet can't sustain it. I mean, the work by, trying to remember his name now, did the book on the ecological footprint out of, I think, Simon Fraser University, Wackernagel, bad pronunciation. You can see it, but can't remember the exact pronunciation. But what is it now? Is it four Earths or five Earths in which our, we actually would require in order to accommodate our standard of living? So we're going to have to learn to do without less. But doing without less doesn't mean real severe hardship. It's not like going back to the 13th or the 14th century that, you know, one of the previous questioners and I had talked about over the break, but rather saying, we do want those vehicles that only get or use 3 liters of gasoline per 100 kilometers. We're only going to accept buildings that have very high insulation and efficiency standards. We're only going to accept energy supplies that are renewable rather than emitting air pollution that kills 20,000 Canadians a year or contributes, a significant portion of our greenhouse gases. So there are a lot of things that we can do and need to do if Canada is going to take on its fair share and responsibility of what clearly has to be a global effort.
Hi, my name is Andrew Farrow, and I've actually got two questions, but I'll let you choose which one you get to answer. One of them's on taxation, and one of them's on environmental impact reports. Which one would you like?
Well, the issue of a carbon tax, whether or not it's seen in a carbon tax or a cap and trade system, it's going to happen. I mean, it's been promoted. Well. Sorry, I'm not advocating it. I'm just saying that it's going to happen. Can you point out in the recording who clapped in the back of the audience? I think that's inevitable. I mean, Obama has already talked about a North American cap-and-trade system. Regardless of what's happening here in Alberta and Ontario or Ottawa, which seems to think intensity targets will be sufficient to get us accepted by other trading partners, it ain't going to fly. And when you look at what's happening through the Western Climate Initiative out of California, there's one in central USA and Illinois and a number of other provinces, or states rather, and provinces, and also one in eastern US, which is involving some of the Canadian provinces as well. Oddly enough, this is going to be a provincial and state initiative, almost from the bottom up. Quebec, BC already has a carbon tax, that little bit on thin ice over that one, but it's going to happen, and we're going to have to get our heads around the efficacy and the specifics of the rules and regulations to make that happen in a fair and manageable way. So your other question was on...
It's actually on the environmental impact reports. Specifically regarding today I was watching the question and answer period for the Parliament, and somebody mentioned that they've removed the impact reports for the surface of water as opposed to... Yeah, and I was just wondering how much of an effect that has on...
I can't mention that specifically. I can say is this, is that there has been some discussion, low-level discussion, I suspect in some provinces and some efforts federally, to think about including climate change into environmental impact assessments. University of Toronto, where I'm an associate member of the faculty, had taken a leadership role in that area a number of years ago, and it's been included in things such as Confederation Bridge, which connects PEI with the mainland. I did research on that, and essentially there was a 1 meter added on to the height of the bridge to accommodate 1 meter sea level rise. Right, and that's, championed out there as this is an example of adaptation to climate change. And yet when I talked to the engineer who did it, I said, why did you do it? He says, because those SOBs in Ottawa wouldn't approve my environmental assessment until I raised the height of it by a meter. I thought, oh, great, that's reassuring. Thank you very much. But nonetheless, logically, you would think through environmental assessments, both from a mitigation side and an adaptation side, that's how we need to go. Now, having said that, Jim, Tom, others in the audience, how many adaptation experts you think there are in this country? How many adaptation experts, engineers notwithstanding, who might think themselves as experts, are out there in the consulting world who can work with different firms with every different proposed project that's subject to an EAI assessment? Environmental impact assessment. Actually have the adaptation knowledge to include that in that assessment process. Probably very low. And I'm sitting back thinking, oh, great, I should be advocating this because then I'll be gainfully employed until I'm 105. But it's something I think we need to do, and yet I doubt very much the expertise exists. Now, just turn this around a little bit and look at all the thrust right now on critical infrastructure and investment needs for critical infrastructure to reinvigorate the economy. You know, and the buzzword isn't, well, are we going to accommodate the long-term need changes that are going to occur with climate change that are going to affect the lifespan and the life expectancy of our bridges, our roads, and our buildings? No. The buzzword is, what's shovel-ready so that we can fund, get the money flowing, and kickstart the economy? How that jives with the climate change reality is beyond me. And in fact, you know, my cynicism says, great, you know, not only will we not have proper consideration of adaptation through this critical infrastructure initiative, but we're going to see a pipe connecting James Bay down through the Great Lakes down to Arizona, and they're going to approve it, fast-track it through the environmental impact assessment process, and that will be a showcase as, here it is, adaptation to climate change. Now, I'm being cynical when I say that. But there are times when I wonder, well, where are we going? What is actually being done? What are we really thinking in terms of how we need to look at impacts and adaptation more carefully and incorporate it into the planning process in a more logical, sane, and strategic manner? And I don't know the answer to that question because those types of outcomes have yet to be determined. And thank goodness we have people like many of you in the room today who hopefully will have a vocal voice. Well, that's a great one. Have a strong voice in terms of challenging decision makers to make the right decisions.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
My name is Neil Merrill. Quinton, I know there's a couple of people in the room that have thought about this a lot, Jim Byrne and Tom Johnson, but I'd like you to talk a little bit about it. We're in southern Alberta, this home of irrigation agriculture. Water's a big deal. Talk to us a little bit about adaptability given climate change and shortage of water. Things like you already talked about, moving water from James Bay to Arizona, interbasin transfer, going back to dryland farming, returning the landscape to native grass and kicking all the irrigation farmers out. What can be done?
That's an excellent question, and I would almost feel more comfortable with Jim coming to the podium to answer it. But let me answer it this way, and hopefully you can correct me or steer me in the right direction. But my sense from reading the chapter and hearing presentations from Dave Sochin and others is that certainly water scarcity, as I mentioned in my presentation, is the number one concern for the prairies. And obviously this is an area where irrigation is essential to the diversity and the intensity of agriculture and the types of products that are grown and the rest of it. I gather in our recent history, and I think it was the reference in the report to St. Mary's Irrigation District, was it 60% below what it normally, or allocation of only 60% of water to users in the area? And there's no doubt that recent history has demonstrated that drought is a problem, that water resources will become a problem and could be exacerbated under climate change. Now, I have always thought, while with the declining water supplies through glacial retreat and changes in snow melt and the rest of it, that this part of the province 100 years from now or 50 years from now, I don't know quite date what type of tipping point or threshold would have to be reached in order to virtually stop any kind of reliance upon irrigation. I don't think that anyone really knows that. I don't think that's a question that you can say with any degree of certainty. It's 100 years from now, 50 years, or 20 years from now. I've heard people like David Schindler speak on the subject, and when I heard him speak to energy providers in Ontario, presented a much dire warning in terms of what will happen with retreating glaciers and spring melt and the rest of it. Dave's interpretation in the prayer chapter wasn't quite as dire, but certainly would pose significant challenges. And I think one of the things we also have to recognize, and I saw this firsthand in July 2007 when I was hiking through the Rockies, and Yoho National Park especially, I've never seen water levels so high. Why were they so high? Well, the amount of glacial retreat, the amount of snowpack, and June just was frigging hot. I mean, you had records June, I think, in 2007 that was unheard of. And so you get into this false sense of security that, wow, there's a whole bunch of water available, when in fact at some point you know that ain't going to be the case. And I was in Juneau, Alaska, I was part of an Alaskan cruise. I took my mother and sister, so give me some brownie point. And I was looking at, trying to remember the Mendenhall Glacier. What is it? Mendenhall Glacier. And I had a quiet conversation with a U.S. Forestry Service guy or whoever is the conservation person there. And I said, geez, that's... Glacier seems to have retreated with the spill lake that's in front. He says, yeah, well, it used to be there where they built the restaurant and the tourist facility, and it's like it's now like half a mile back. He said, that's just in the last like 10 years. He says, we're really worried about this, because once this glacier retreats by a certain point, all of the tourism, at least for that particular spot, gone. But more broadly, in terms of what does this mean for the watersheds in the area. So, I mean, Jim, I don't know what your thoughts are in answering that question, but my sense is that it is a possibility, probably not in my lifetime, and what I'd be more concerned about is not just simply water drying up. Just as water scarcity becomes a chronic problem, as the population and the economy continues to grow and water needs become all that much greater, how do you reconcile those competing interests? And I think it's prudent upon all of us to use water more effectively. And when you look at Pollution Probe's water workshop series to inform the development of a national vision and strategy on water, more efficient use of water was front and central. And, you know, we are such a wasteful society in Canada, you know, by our per capita energy use and water use. It's mind-boggling sometimes in terms of how we use it. So pricing, I think, was mentioned in the report is something that's essential. And I know that when we were doing research back in the 90s, Carolyn, I mean, you may have your own thoughts as an irrigation farmer, to the extent that you buy your permit and you can basically withdraw as much water as you want. At least that was the case, I thought, in the mid-90s. So there are good examples of where adaptation and new technologies, and again, the kinds of things that I think, certainly specific to southern Alberta, have broad applicability, widespread interest in other jurisdictions that are going to experience even more severe water shortages than here. So it's a challenge. I think we're becoming better educated, better informed, smarter in the way we do business, and certainly farmers, as we know, are generally amongst the smartest there are. So, of course I'm going to say that. and I mean it as well. But they are. I mean, they are smart, and they have their finger on the pulse of weather and climate and technologies. They'll adapt, but I think pricing is very much central to it.
I'm Hester Giscoud. I'm a professor at the University of Lethbridge in the same department as Tom and Jim, and I'm a glaciologist, so I'm not going to ask questions about glaciers. Both in the mitigation and in the adaptation, the examples that you use and that the governments in Canada and in the rest of North America use are mostly technology-based rather than people's adaptation and a shift in lifestyle. So what do you think is actually the role of governments and of research institutes like yours to actually inform the people and maybe press them or push them into changing their lifestyles? Because first of all, we can have immediate impacts rather than having to wait for the technology to come or having to buy them. And good information about how to adapt your lifestyle might actually help the normal people like us and everybody else to adapt straight away.
No, that's an excellent question. And I think a reasonable answer to that is that, and you may not be happy with what I'm about to say, is that I think there's a false belief that improved awareness leads to behavioral change. I don't believe that for a minute. It's certainly a start, and necessary, but not sufficient for change. So it goes back to the role of, if not government in terms of regulations, because I don't believe that we can just regulate everything. There are, in fact, a whole bunch of different instruments and tools available to government through voluntary initiatives and a whole bunch of other things to promote changes and cause changes to occur. But changes in the marketplace. So there's got to be a market signal. And one of the organizations I'm very proud to sit on their board is the Clean Air Foundation. And it's a market transformation company. And I think, well, they have a not-for-profit organization. But they promote car heaven, which is vehicle scrappage, mow down pollution, which gets old lawnmowers out and more fuel-efficient or electric or push mowers back in, mercury switch out and getting mercury switches out of vehicles and thermometers and thermostats in homes, and all sorts of related programs and compact fluorescent bulbs, which unfortunately is also a potential source of mercury into the environment, but a much positive influence in terms of energy efficiency. So there are a number of things that ultimately I think the marketplace will have to be a key driver. There's no way around it in terms of the global economy. And what irks me right now is this false dichotomy that somehow environment is contrary to a revived economy, when I think evidence has shown, certainly through air quality management, acid rain and the like, that investing in environmental technologies and enhancing performance increases your bottom line. And we need to do more about selling mitigation and adaptation as economic win-wins rather than as doom and glooms and somehow shutting down the economy. I think the years and decade ahead, which pose some real serious economic challenges, also represents a huge opportunity. And I think those who are smart and those who are early adopters and leaders will start identifying and following others who are taking the lead in new technologies and new and creative ways of doing things, because I think that's our only hope in terms of getting out of both the economic and the environmental mess that we're in. So
don't you think in that sense the government has to take a lead? For example, Calgary started, at least in this province, but since a while, Lethbridge also has a no-idling policy.
No-idling?
Their vehicles
can't
idle for longer than a certain period.
Yes.
And other examples are that if they actually water their lawn, that the either provincial or local lawn, that they do it before sunrise and after sunset. And the government and even universities or official buildings can actually take the lead in that respect rather than really having
to change
policies.
I mean, policy, regulation, building codes, fuel economy standards, all of these things are absolutely essential for us to move the yardsticks forward. I'm not sure, though, to the degree that government can really regulate everything. I mean, I think we've got to pick our spots realistically. And there's also the notion, I think, of corporate leadership is absolutely essential. And I'm constantly mind-boggled by the fact that you have even some of the dirtiest industries, and fossil fuel in particular, who, at least behind closed doors, realize the significance of the problem and really want to make an effort and do things right. And yet other companies that just totally don't get it. And I'm going to finish off by one quick anecdote of a fast food icon in the Canadian landscape that produces donuts. And they had commissioned a report by the Canadian Restaurant and Hospitality or Association that looked at drive-thrus and looked at drive-thrus emissions during the early morning rush hour and looked at three restaurants with drive-thrus, one without. Said it took the one without 8 minutes to park. Therefore, drive-thrus, which are only 6 minutes idling through the drive-thrus, drive-thrus are good for climate change and air pollution. Excuse me? And I said, well, all your report shows, it also demonstrates that if you park your car and walk 20 feet, you emit one-third the emissions than you would by going through a drive-thru. That the other 23 hours of operation that you're open, or 17 hours if you're only a 6 to midnight operation, means you should shut those drive-thrus down. And their response was actually to get in London, Ontario, a survey where they basically had elderly men with walkers, pregnant women, and women with babies as champion drive-thrus. And I thought to myself, this is like cowboy country, where you're cowboys and Indians, where you circle the wagons, in this case circling around those that have, you know, certain limitations, mobility situations or constraints. And it's mind-boggling. So how can you do that? I mean, it's such a ridiculous corporate position to take. And yet how many drive-thrus do we have out there? It generates 40-50% of McDonald's, Tim Hortons, Wendy's, all the major fast food companies out there, of their revenues. So what do we do? I'm not out there advocating shut them down. Believe it or not, I'm out there advocating, why don't you use your drive-thru as an opportunity to educate the public, bring to their attention their own personal contribution to air pollution and climate change through their carbon footprint, of which drive-thrus is one, and ask them voluntarily, like passing the pot around in this place, make a 10-cent contribution towards a carbon fund or give it to Pollution Pro, and we'll match it. And I'm still waiting for a corporate leader to take that initiative and follow that path, rather than standing there with the ridiculous report that suggests that drive-thrus are good for climate change.
Quentin, we're out of time. I have one question that requires a yes or no answer. Has Obama invited you to be on his the North American Energy Policy Committee yet? Yes or no?
No.
All right. Is Pollution Probe going to try to figure out how you have some impact on the North American policy on energy?
That's a good question. When I raise that with my boss, I'll let you know.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming. Could you please express...
Thanks for inviting me.